Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuha.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's May 6th, 2018.
Right.
The day after Cinco de Mayo.
It's an easy way to remember it, yes.
We celebrated heavily.
Right, we went...
By having ramen for dinner.
It's traditional. We had a ramen holiday. A reference that no one in that restaurant would possibly get. But in any event, that's the way we celebrated Cinco de Mayo, and it was nice.
It was fantastic. Also, next week is Mother's Day.
Oh, really?
Just putting that out there so people are prepared. Start cooking those breakfasts in bed for mom now. Get it together.
Okay. I don't know what you're looking at me for, but fine. Good. Good.
No, I'm just doing it as a public service.
Okay, good.
I'm not looking at you.
Oh, thanks.
Good. Lord knows. Not looking to you.
All right. So in any event, another busy week.
Wait a minute. Kentucky what? Derby.
That's part of the busy
week. You
want
to speak to that?
Busy week. The best horse didn't win. We haven't looked at the videotape yet. Mendelsohn is who we chose. But, you know, it's always a long shot in the Derby. And the favorite one. That's no fun. And the story of the Derby was the weather. So, as it happens sometimes, the favorite was a mutter who had previously won a race by 6 lengths in the rain, and you had the rain, and that kind of was a foregone conclusion. So there you go. So we look forward to the Preakness in 2 weeks, right?
I suppose so.
I suppose so. So on Thursday, we saw Summer and Smoke at the Classic Stage Company downtown. And it was excellent.
Well, it was a terrific production.
Yes.
And it was starring a woman named Maren Ireland, who was quite, I thought, amazing, engaging, charismatic, really brought her role alive. And the male lead was Nathan Darrow.
And I thought he was great. I liked him too. The part isn't quite as big. But they were an excellent match. And, you know, I have to say, I'm not the hugest Tennessee Williams fan. I came to the theater with some trepidation. Why? Because Tennessee Williams gets to be kind of a thick, murky, humid. As the Times says in the review, when you go through the dialogue, you have to cut the butterfat. There's a lot in there. It's kind of lugubrious. And I don't really go for that, generally speaking. It's kind of neo-Gothic or something. But having said that, this production really engaged me. And for the first time, I was at a Tennessee Williams play where I was really drawn in by the dialogue, which was brilliantly written and brilliantly delivered. And this fascinating byplay between these two possibly romantic characters. I thought it was great.
Well, I think this is a case of presentation is everything.
Yeah.
And another standout was Mrs. Weinmuller, played by Barbara Walsh, who is one of these lesser characters that kind of helps bring the piece alive. I mean, I am not a Tennessee Williams fan.
Right.
I mean, really? Even this play, the subject matter,
right.
You know, it's this young woman who's kind of saying, oh, should I remain a, you know, quiet, virginal, intellectual lady?
Yes. But,
or should I give in to my passions?
Yeah, right, right. But the whole point is she doesn't say that, and she doesn't say it like that.
That is the conflict.
You don't want to give the wrong impression. That's not the feeling of the production.
I mean, it's not the feeling of the production, and to the actors. But it really, you know, the subject matter of Tennessee Williams, I don't find compelling at all.
Right, but this play was compelling. I mean, I would say, you know, the closest comparison of things we've seen recently would be Three Tall Women to some degree, which is quite different. But I found this more compelling than Three Tall Women for one simple reason, is that Three Tall Women, those are monologues. And this is more of a play with characters interacting in their dialogues, and it gives you that much more of a dynamic, and it's equally articulate as Three Tall Women. I mean, I really thought it was something. I would encourage folks to get tickets. The problem is this. The play only runs through the month at Classic Stage Company through the end of May, number one. Well, they did extend it that last week of May. And number two, it's a small theater.
Right.
So you might have trouble getting tickets. The good news is there will only be $60. If you get them, and the bad news is you might not be able to get them. But
no, we encourage you, because Marin Ireland is scintillating.
And it's not just us. I think we should say the reviews were very positive across the board. The Times, semi-positive, but a much more glowing review even in New York Magazine, in Vulture.com, and in other similar sites. Really over-the-top reviews. So in any event, again, Summer and Smoke, Classic Stage Company. And this week we're going to see something else. This week we're going to see, we're going to be at Encores, as we are every Encores performance. These are the, what they call the concert performances. It's a weekend of performances, reviving plays. They do three a season. The third one, which runs from Wednesday to Sunday of this week, is Me and My Girl. Me and My Girl was the rage of London in the 1930s. It was revived and somewhat rewritten for the late 1980s by a group that included Stephen Fry.
I think is cool. And to great acclaim, it played for 8 years in the 80s.
Right.
And it came to the U.S.
And it was very successful here, too.
And you know who was in it in London? Oh. Emma Thompson.
Really? Yeah, no, I read that. You're right.
And then part of at a certain point, the cast in the U.S. included like Jim Dale, Tim Curry.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I know it came over with Robert Lindsay, who was nominated for Tony.
We'll see. I mean, hopefully it's one of those things that is more than the sum of its parts.
Well, but they have Christian Borle, and Christian Borle is probably as big a name as you get for a male lead in Broadway
musicals.
And he's
usually terrific.
Yeah, and he was in Something Rotten, and he was in Falsettos, and he was in Peter and the Starcatchers. He's a big name. So And
the TV show?
Smash. There you go. Smash. That's how we first got on the board. Yeah, and their stuff is always great. So in any event, it's
but
Wednesday,
the big
Sunday.
Song is Lambeth Walk.
Well, let's not dwell on that. But in any event, it's worth checking into. It's almost always worth seeing.
Right. So the other exciting thing that's happening in New York this week is the Rockefeller auction.
Right, right.
Okay, so we have Swedish Death Cleaning hits the well-to-do.
Right.
And so David Rockefeller Jr. Died.
The third, I believe it's the third, but. Whatever.
No, I think it might be Junior.
Whatever.
Anyway, he is the grandson of John D.
Yeah, okay.
He lived to be over 100. Mm-hmm. He died a couple years ago, and his estate is going to hit Christie's, mm-hmm. and they expect it to go for around $1 billion.
Around $1 billion, yeah.
Around $1 billion. This would double the previous record, which was the estate of Yves Saint Laurent, mm-hmm. Which brought in about $484 million, mm-hmm. In 2009. And it's art objects, it's dinner services. Uh-huh. Apparently he and his wife had 67 dinner services, mm-hmm. including one that had belonged to Napoleon.
Oh, really?
During his exile in Elba. It's furniture, it's tchotchkes, and it's fantastic paintings. There's a Picasso that they expect to go probably over 90, maybe over $1 million.
So
the
auction's this weekend, or when is it?
It starts Tuesday, I think. And it goes for several days.
Do you go in person or online?
You can do both.
Really?
You can do either.
So we
can
go
probably by
go
phone as well.
We could buy.
You know, when you
some,
see these big
somewhere.
Auctions, there's always somebody on the phone. Yeah. And it was a whole big deal. It was seriously negotiated. I guess Sotheby's and Christie's were vying for.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't split it. But okay, interesting.
Split it. And all the proceeds would go to charity.
Right, right.
So that. That sounds interesting.
So that sounds like a Saturday for you. You would go to...
It might have even been more work than the big Abuhoff estate.
Well, that's true. So one can plan one's weekend by going to the auction and going to the theater, either Me and My Girl or Summer and Smoke. It's a full weekend.
Right. And as I was reading the New York Times, I was glancing through the travel section, which was kind of fun. And one of the things mentioned in the New York Times travel section was Kleks. Mm. Kleks, squat shops in Sofia, mm-hmm. Bulgaria. Mm. And this just seemed interesting because they are little shops that have cropped up in old bunkers, underground bomb shelters built during World War II, mm-hmm. and basement level mm-hmm. bomb shelters built in Sofia during World War II and subsequently in the Cold War mm-hmm. period. And once communism is beginning to kind of fall apart and is in transition, people are actually starting little businesses mm-hmm. in those basements. Mm-hmm. Shoe repair or selling food items. I think you can only get inside them from within the mm-hmm. building.
Right.
So there's no real storefront. There's just a little teeny window, like you might have in My Sister Eileen, looking out of the yeah. basement at people's feet. And people bend down
right.
and they, hand in their shoes or give their order for the sandwich. And so those have been, kind of underground businesses, both hiding from the authorities, but now just being kind of interesting and intriguing and charming. So that's kind of fun. Kleks. It only in Sofia, Bulgaria.
All right. Well, yeah, I was thinking of locksmiths in New York. Some of them are almost like that, but not quite. There are these spaces underneath, but I think you can actually walk in them. Anyway, hockey and gambling. There hasn't been enough connection between hockey and gambling until now. Why is that? That's because that hockey is the first major sport to have a franchise in Las Vegas. And this year they started with a team called the Las Vegas Golden Knights. And as you might expect, that was greeted very warmly with folks in Vegas, very happy to have a professional team for the first time. They were considered anathema.
Why? They got so much going on.
I'm telling you, tremendous reception for the Las Vegas Golden Knights. And here's the kicker. They've been unbelievably successful, unprecedented in the way they're successful. So much so that they're an first-year team in the league. In terms of, selling seats, that happens a lot.
They're selling seats,
but the team wins.
Okay.
So usually an expansion team languishes near the bottom of the pack. This team has been the top team in the National Hockey League for the whole season, which is crazy. And now they're getting to the playoffs, and they're becoming the favorite to win the Stanley Cup. They're in almost the semifinal round. Well, that's a little bit of a problem. Why is it a problem?
Because, my mother will be upset. She's rooting for the Penguins.
Yes, but beyond your mother. It's a problem because the way that the team has been promoted by the folks running gambling shops in Vegas is to encourage people to bet on the Golden Knights. And they've been doing this in terms of promotions by giving away free options for the team might win, $5 chip that the team will win the Stanley Cup. All kinds of things which were considered worthless at the time because there was no thought that they were going to win the Stanley Cup. Now they might win the Stanley Cup. If they win the Stanley Cup,
the
betting shops in Vegas will lose millions of dollars because they thought they were giving away funny money, mm-hmm. just promoting the team.
What you wish for.
Exactly. So on the one hand, the gambling shops have been benefited by a lot of additional traffic, a lot of excitement in the town about sports generally. That helps them. And people buy food and drink, all good. But if at the end of the day they actually win the Stanley Cup, these guys are in tremendous trouble. So what they're saying, they're putting a nice face on it as best they can because they could have helped getting the phenomenon going. But they keep saying, we want the team to be successful, but next year, not this year. And so you're going to have a lot of mixed feelings if you get to the Stanley Cup Finals.
So do you think any funny business will go on? Like they'll try to pay the guys to throw the games
or
anything?
Well, that's the reason that you never had a Major League franchise in Vegas, because it's the appearance of impropriety, the thought that there could be funny business, because the gamblers are right there. They're right there. So there'll be temptation, but the league's got to count on that not happening. Otherwise, it's a disaster.
Well, that will be interesting.
Yeah.
Also interesting is a scandal involving Jewish-style artichokes in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so recently a rabbi in Israel proclaimed Jewish-style, that is these fried artichokes, to be not kosher,
mm-hmm.
okay, that you can't eat them because some frozen prepared Jewish-style artichokes were found to have worms in them.
Right.
So the feeling being that they're, worms could hide in any artichoke, so that would be treif, so you can't eat them.
Right.
Well, of course, this is the thing for the Roman Jewish ghetto, Jewish sector, and it's a huge, important item. And the idea that Jews can't eat these would be a bad, bad thing economically. Now, the Roman Jews are not too worried about this, or the Roman culinary establishment's not too worried about this, because unlike the Catholic Church, where there is a pope who can make declarations about what is and what isn't, what one rabbi says in Israel doesn't necessarily hold for all Jewish communities all over the world.
Right.
So there is that. And so the Roman Jews have really launched an effort to clear the name of artichokes and prove just how edible they are. It really is a wonderful dish. It involves... double frying the artichokes.
Right.
They fan out like flowers, and that second time you fry them even hotter, they get even more tender and wonderfully...
And no worms are getting through that. You know, it is, first of all, I want to commend you on your use of Yiddish, but for others, treif means non-kosher. And secondly, you're absolutely right about it's not like the papal regime. It's just the opposite. It's not clear what's kosher and what's not. There's a lot of debate. People debate it endlessly. So no one's got the final word on this. And the Romans, you know, have a leg to stand on here in saying it's perfectly kosher.
Also, they say the recipe, people were eating artichokes for hundreds of years before this recipe came about.
Mm.
And somebody would have realized... before 1600, that artichokes were not according to Boyle.
What do the Israelis know about?
But it's very funny. Part of the article is covers one a demonstration of just how wonderful and clean these are.
Yeah.
And somebody is bothering the lady who's in charge of it. What time will it start? And she says it starts at 4 Italian time, not 4 German time, which... Well, I think you think of Germans as always being precise, accurate, the money. And, you know, Italians, it'll start at 4-ish kind of thing. And if anyone's wondering what these taste like.
Yeah. What?
Any thoughts?
I don't.
Kind of like a artichoke flavored potato chip, really.
Yeah. But fresh potato chip because it's just fried.
Yes, they're pretty fabulous. Yeah. And then in the Wall Street Journal, they're... was an article titled Give Processed Food a Break.
Right.
And it says modern food technology creates some abominations, but also gives us better nutrition and variety and less waste. And so it's kind of embracing the idea that we, I think we're all comfortable with the idea that processed food is a no-no, that it's generally going to have more sugar, more salt, things you can't pronounce, that are not so good for you. That's, standard understanding of food at the moment, I think. So this is coming out and saying, well, maybe there's some value to these items. And the author, Nicola Temple, actually says, well, for instance, there's frozen vegetables, which are often frozen at the height of their nutritional value.
So they maintain their nutrients.
Yeah, you know,
right.
They could be better.
Right.
She also cites a story from 2012, actually done in the UK, that says that they compared prepared foods to recipes for home cooking from leading UK chefs and found that generally the prepared items had lower calorie counts, less saturated fat, and more fiber than 100 popular recipes. But they also noted that these items fall short of nutritional standards.
Yeah, I don't know. Look, I think the article comes down to three words, which is compare to what? You know, I mean, are they the worst thing for you? No, they're not the worst thing for you. Are they the best thing for you? No. I mean, the question is, what are you eating if you don't eat this? And we were discussing before when my parents were older, you know, if they weren't eating a lean cuisine item, which is in the middle somewhere, they were eating a bagel with a piece of American cheese, and that's not so great. So it's better than a lot of things, right? It's
right, just not but she the also best. Says she's in favor of some preservatives because She says, for instance, my family loves tortillas, and we use tortilla wraps everything.
That, yeah.
Okay?
Right.
I went to the trouble, she says, to make homemade.
Right.
And within, you know, an hour, they're, you know, hard as bricks.
Right. So I remember. She said
she's in favor of the glycerol that keeps commercial tortillas.
It's called a humectant.
It's a humectant, yes. Right. So and she says, I'm not interested in preservatives, but I embrace humectants.
Right. Well,
okay. Yeah. I'm not sure those commercial tortillas are all that.
Well, if it makes her feel any better or worse, the commercial tortilla business is a huge business.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
And the humectants have been a huge thing for them.
And
so
she also does point out that if you make your own lasagna, you have all these leftover items in the fridge.
Right.
You know, you'd have to be, you know, a home economist to figure out how to use up the rest of the ricotta, et cetera, and so forth. Really?
Yeah.
That's your excuse?
I don't know. At that point, the article falls off. But in any event, yeah, it's not the worst thing in the world to eat. But it's just, you know, compared
I'm
to
not
what,
persuaded. Maybe you're persuaded.
Well, it depends
by
what else
Ms.
it is.
Temple, but, you know.
It depends what else, what you'd be eating otherwise. So, the NBA, since we're going to spend time on the NHL, we have to go back to the NBA. And rather than get into the day-by-day, the playoffs, which we'll get into soon enough, the big story is that it turns out that the players are cursing out the referees. Well, that's not news. But they're cursing them out in all kinds of languages now, which is much more exciting. There are 62 foreign-born players in the NBA. They're from 33 countries. They all have native tongues other than English. And as a result, referees are getting cursed out in Turkish, Spanish, Serbian, Portuguese, etc. And they don't know when to call a technical or not. It's not quite clear to them. They like to call technical when they get cursed out by a player, but they're not sure if they're being cursed at because they don't understand the language.
I wonder if any of these words will make it into the American vernacular.
There's some discussion about some of the young players in the NBA learning the words and helping getting them into the vernacular, but the Times says they can't discuss it because they don't want to put those words in the newspaper, but you might be onto something. Plus, you know, a lot of these guys... it's quite interesting. A lot of these players, I'm just saying they're foreign-born, but I'm not giving them enough credit. They speak several languages.
Yeah.
So you have Serge Ibaka, for example, who's a Congolese-born power forward now playing for the Raptors. He recently had a news conference where he answered consecutive questions in English, French, and Spanish. And several of them speak more than one language. So there's a new thought among the international players, and this is expressed by Marcin Gortat, who plays for the Washington Wizards. He says, you know something? My own thinking is that if you're going to be a man and you're going to curse out a referee, curse him out in English. Curse him out so that he understands. And if they fine you, be a man and pay the fine. But it's the chicken way to go to curse him out in Turkish.
Well, that's sort of true. If the guy doesn't know he's being cursed out, does it really count?
That's right. So, and yet people tend to curse that are angered, they're losing their temper, they're not thinking.
Well, remember that story we did about profanity has real effects?
Oh, yeah, it helps
like
you.
Like real positive
That's
effects?
What, so this is so why the international players are being
you know,
helped out.
They're
blowing off steam. And they're staying in the game, not getting thrown out. So that's why that they're having such an impact.
I mean, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
The refs don't know they're being cursed at, and the cursing does its job.
No wonder basketball's so popular.
Okay, yeah. I have a new hero.
Yeah.
Mathilde Freund.
Well, the best part about this article is that this woman, who you'll get to in a minute, who's 101 years old, is written up in the How I Spend My Sundays piece, which is usually someone who's like some young woman, short, blonde-haired talk host, and not her. She's different, right?
Well, I mean, it's in the Metropolitan section of the New York Times where it's the Sunday routine. And it's usually somebody running around to the exercise class and taking care of the kids and meeting friends for brunch.
Right.
And, et cetera,
and writing
et cetera.
A novel between 4 and 5 o'clock.
For
right?
30 years, yeah. Mathilde Freund has been selling vintage clothing and jewelry, etc., at the Grand Bazaar NYC, a flea market on Columbus Avenue in New York City. So she gets up on Sunday.
And again,
she gets up at 5.
When you say
30
years, these are the years between 71 and 101.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is you know, comforting for me.
Yes.
This is a new career she started in her 70s.
There's still time.
Okay.
For this,
and she gets up and somebody helps her get her stuff to the flea market, right. And she sells things somewhat occasionally. Right. She mentions one set of pots or something.
Butter dishes.
3 years.
Butter dishes. Yeah, for 3 years.
She got a few good price.
Then she made a good sale. Three of them for $75.
But it took 3 years.
It was worth
and,
it.
But she does this every Sunday, and I was really impressed. Sort of interesting, articulate woman, still taking cappuccino.
Right.
At Starbucks.
Every once
at
in a while. One of her best lines was she says, you know, once in a while she goes down in price because, you know, you got to keep your customers.
Yeah.
Says she wants to keep them happy. Yeah, she's got quite the thriving business or not, but it gives her something to focus on, and she has a full day.
Hats off to yes. Ms. Freund.
Ms. Freund, yes. So here's another change in career situation. It's just a little bit different. It's kind of an interesting story about a guy who was a basketball player. Big star growing up in high school, played a lot of travel ball, somehow ended up at Brown, which you don't think of a basketball hotbed, but as a 6'8", excellent shooting forward, has some thoughts about a professional career. And then, after having a great first season at Brown, contracted what he thought was mononucleosis. It ended up being an extreme strain of Epstein-Barr virus. And it was so bad that he couldn't return to school for his sophomore year, and he had to stay home. He was so weak, he couldn't do anything. And he ended up somehow playing with the drums a little bit. He had played drums as a kid. He played with a computer. He sort of learned some of the tech about being a DJ. And that's all he did for like a whole year. He couldn't even read. He says he's somewhat dyslexic, but he's also exhausted. He made it back to school the following year. He played basketball. And it was really tough for him. He had one great game that was nationally televised, and he hit the game-winning shot, a three-pointer. And he was sitting in the clubhouse after the game, and he couldn't stand up. He was so weak, and he said to himself,
"That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it." And sure enough, when he saw the doctor a little later than that, he said, "I won't clear you to play. You can't play. It'll kill you." And he was done. And he decided that, first of all, he was an art and art history major, interestingly enough. And he told his parents he'd finish and get his degree, but he was really interested in music. So he started, you know, he continued to pursue the music. He dragged his equipment to go as a DJ any way he could. He developed his ability to use the drums and beats, whatever. He can sing a little bit. And it's at one of these gigs, and I should give the fellow's name. His name is Tucker Halpern. He saw a woman whose name is Ms. Holly Weld. And Holly Weld impressed him. She sang bossa nova. He decided that, Sophie Holy Health. He decided that she, as good as she was, she'd be a lot better if she just sped it up. Consistent with his idea of the beat and everything that he does with the drums. And he sort of took her aside afterwards. He got her to chat her up and he tried to urge her to do this. They started making some music together. And it clicked. It clicked. She was a student at Brown. It was a transfer student. She had other plans, but he persuaded her that they should give this music thing a try. And they did various gigs as opening acts, and it just built up in terms of popularity, and now they're headliners, and they become quite popular. They have a Grammy-nominated dance pop duo, they're on their way. And they were even featured on the Apple ads that you see on television in terms of music bits. And the best part of this, as I told you before, is the name of the group formed by Tucker Halpern and Sophie Holy Weld is Sophie Tucker.
That's fun. That's fun.
As we've talked about Sophie Tucker in the past.
That's right.
Which is nothing like this. But this is the new iteration. This guy's got a great story. And they're fun. We'll play you a clip of them at the end. But that's the new Sophie Tucker. So life goes on.
Now, for those in our listening audience who are fans of the Victorian era,
yeah,
there's a new book out called Victorians Undone,
right,
by Catherine Hughes. And there's a review of that in the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, every few years somebody writes something about, you know, you think the Victorians were so Victorian? Not really. And they tell all these scandalous tales.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not going to talk much about this book. It seems kind of fun. The first thing it talks about is why all these Victorian gentlemen, Charles Darwin, Dickens, etc., were beard-wearing fellows. Mm-hmm. And the fun part of that story is I learned a new word, and that is paganophobe. That means one who fears beards. Mm. On the flip side of that, if you are a lover of beards, you are a paganophiliac.
Yeah.
So a lot of that going around. That's a fun word. Do you think all those guys in Brooklyn with the beards know about those words? I don't know.
No.
Then, you know, it has various stories, including one that we were wondering if it was true because we came across it on a miniseries about Victoria.
Oh, that's been on Channel 13.
So there's a scandalous sex story there where Victoria, the brand new queen, is trying to run a taut ship with high ethical standards and moral standards, and she fears that somebody in her entourage is pregnant and unwed because she has a swelling. Mm-hmm. She seems to be swelling. She has her rather fumbling older doctor check this person out. Turns out she's not pregnant. Mm-hmm. She was still a virgin, and that in fact she has some kind of tumor and dies of that.
Well, it was a sad story on the television, but this was much more detailed than that, and this made the whole situation, including the examination by the doctor, seem a lot rougher. But you were onto that story even when we were watching it on TV. You seem to know all about that.
No, not really.
No?
But I was sitting there saying, could this possibly be true? And then, of course, the sad ending to that is the same doctor doesn't quite, what is it, he misdiagnosed
Prince Albert.
Albert's fatal typhoid.
Right. So he's bad news from the get-go. But it's more details about the
Victorians. But anyway, if you're interested in odd tales, many of them rather
unseemly.
Scandalous,
yes.
Unseemly, things we can't talk about on the radio, get this book. Victorians Undone.
Right. And speaking of undone, there's the Tappan Zee Bridge.
Yeah, the Tappan Zee Bridge. Who doesn't love the Tappan Zee Bridge? But there's a new one now, or two of them, actually. The old one's being torn down, and guess what? It's being toted out to Long Island.
Is that right?
Used as artificial reefs.
Really?
And so that lobsters and other sea creatures will breed and live and thrive in the nooks and crannies of these old bits and pieces. So it will have a very positive effect, we hope, on the environment.
Oh, that's funny. I had no idea. All right. So, and we had, I actually spotted this. You'd never see this in the New York Times. It was an obituary page in which the top half of the page was about a woman passing away, and the bottom half of the page was about her husband passing away.
They died within an hour.
Of each other.
Judith Lieber and her husband, Gerson Lieber.
And they were, I should say, 96 and 97.
96 and 97. She was the great designer of handbags, the Judith Lieber handbags, which I've seen for sale in like auctions at art houses and so on. They're very collectible. She was actually, where was she born?
Hungary. Yeah.
It's
one of those stories where her family was at risk with respect to the Nazis.
Her family wanted her to be a chemist.
Right.
They had some relative who had made a fortune in cream.
Cosmetology. And she was going to study that.
So she was sent to England to study chemistry. The war comes around, Nazis come around, and that puts an end to that. She actually manages to get into an artisan school, a guild school, and learns the craft of handbag making.
Right.
And she and her family manage to survive.
Yeah, but they just manage, and it's a pretty harrowing situation, and they end up in sleeping in very small quarters, end up having almost no food to eat. It's pretty touch and go.
Well, she avoids concentration camp, I think, because she can sew.
Right.
And
there's also some help that comes from outside.
They force her to sew the army uniforms, etc. So, but, you know, by hook or by crook, she survives. Meanwhile, Mr. Lieber is stationed there. He comes from Titusville, New Jersey. Titusville, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Oh, darn, because there's a Titusville, New Jersey right near us here.
Close enough.
But
he meets her family while they're in distress. And one of the ways that he connects with them he invites her to the opera when he sees her on the street. But beyond that, he brings them canned goods, like canned chicken and stuff like that. Army
Which
rations.
They are so thankful for, right. Because at one point she and her family are living with 26 people
in
a one-room
house, right.
And they're eating things like...
No, don't tell us. But, right. But the point is that... That's the connection. It seems like it's not a promising way to begin a long relationship, but it obviously does. The other thing is that he's interested in art. And while he's in Hungary, he studies art in Hungary, which I thought was interesting. So he studies art in 1946 in Hungary. And
eventually they end up in New York.
They end up back in the United States. And they get married.
They get married. And she actually starts making handbags.
Right. Works for a company first. Then she starts her own company.
Well, part of what she's doing is actually jobbing the handbags out to, existing plants, existing companies.
Yeah, okay.
And then eventually she'll be designing things that are sent over to Italy to be, the wax models are cast into metal and then brought back to the U.S. and carefully encrusted with rhinestones and gold plated. And she has, fantastic animal shape, all kinds of, scenes and skylines of New York.
And she becomes a great favorite of these society women, and she's selling these handbags, which are collectibles,
right.
For a great bit of money. He helps the business. At the same time, he becomes a painter.
Right.
Right. And, who has some success. I wouldn't, he's not monumental success, but some success, and his stuff is in museums. And they make more than a go of it. They become quite a big deal.
Yeah. And there are all kinds of great stories of various, presidential wives carrying them, celebrities, Greta Garbo, Queen Elizabeth.
Greta Garbo?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And they're very small little bags,
right.
Just big enough to carry a lipstick, a handkerchief, and a $100 bill.
Right.
And she said, well, what else do you need? And they said, well, what about this? This and the other thing. She said, what's an escort for?
Yeah.
He carries that stuff.
There you go.
And for you. And people actually will come into controversy in divorce proceedings over
who gets the bags. Who
the
gets
bags.
The bags. And the journal actually covered it too. The journal said the Liebers had no children. Ms. Lieber said her bags were her offspring. Quote, and there is no college tuition, and nobody talks back. So there you go. Interesting. And they died within 1 hour of each other, 96, 97. So I guess that's a marriage that seemed to work. Okay. So
that's it for today.
That's it for today. We're going to leave you with
We're going to try to conjure up
a clip.
A little bit of Sophie Tucker.
Of Sophie Tucker. And it's music that you'll probably recognize from the Apple ads. But it's the new Sophie Tucker, not the old Sophie Tucker. And we'll see you next week on Mother's Day.
On Mother's Day.
Right. We'll broadcast on Mother's Day.
Am I available Mother's Day? Let me think about that.
We'll see.
Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. We'll be back.
Thanks.
I think that I'll keep loving you way past 65. We made a language for us two. We don't need to describe. Every time you call on me, I drop what I do. You are my best friend and we've got some shit to shoot.
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me in the lounge?
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me in the club?
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me downtown?
Okay.
Yo, you wanna meet me in the east?
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me in the west?
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me on the block?
Yeah.
Yo, you wanna meet me at the spot?
Okay.
I think that I'll keep loving you way past 65. We made a language for us two. We don't need to describe. Every time you call on me, I